This is Sarah Robinson, and you're listening to Conscious Creating. Today I'll be talking with
Kimberly Juergen. Kimberly Juergen makes her home in Atlanta, Georgia, where she works as freelance actor and director in film and theater throughout the United States. For 10 years, she was the founding artistic director of ACT, Atlanta Classical Theater, one of Georgia's most exciting theater companies, offering an innovative approach to the classics. Kimberly Juergen, welcome to Conscious Creating.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be here.
You know, you and I hail from the same state. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Yes? Whereabouts in Tennessee you come from, girl?
Well, now, you see, I was born in Chattanooga, but I was raised in Nashville. We moved when I was just real little.
Oh, well, see, now, I was born in Memphis and was raised in Chattanooga, so. God, actors, put them together. How long did you live there?
In Chattanooga, I was there for, I don't know, maybe a year or two, and then my parents moved back to Nashville, where both of their families were.
Oh, okay. So, did the arts figure prominently in your childhood?
Not really. We didn't go to a lot of events, but there was the Broadway tours that would come through town, and occasionally we would have tickets to that.
Right, like what kinds of things did you see?
Well, the first show that I really remember seeing was The King and I, and Yul Brynner was touring in it.
Mm.
And it was magical. His curtain call, I mean, I still get chills when I think about it. It was so incredible. And just the way he moved the whole audience, and it was like one collective energy that he created. And it just blew me away, and I still remember it and just enjoying it even now.
He does have a powerful energy, doesn't he?
Oh, he certainly did.
Hmm. So was that where you remember becoming fascinated with acting for the first time?
Absolutely.
Was it acting or showbiz, or what was it really?
I think it was that ability to move people. And I was so young at the time, it didn't have like a specific, a specific expression. If it was the showmanship or the creativity. But it was just, there was just something about that that mesmerized me in the ability to move people and make everybody in the room feel one thing.
It is magical, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So you had your first stage performance at 12.
Yes, right? Actually, I was a little bit younger than that when I had my very first stage performance. It was in first grade, and I was in a crowd scene. It was a school production, and I was a crowd scene, and it was Jack and the Beanstalk. And so Jack has bought this sack of sugar, and he's carrying it back home, and a hole gets punctured in it, and all the sugar falls out. Well, we were using popcorn for sugar, and I love popcorn. Always have, always will. And so she needed a couple of townspeople to come out of the crowd and go up and start gobbling up the fallen sugar. And so she picked me, and that was my first, you know, being pulled out of the chorus and getting a spotlight moment. And I was hooked. I loved that.
And you got to eat on stage.
Absolutely. And my favorite food. I mean, we've all had to eat things on stage that we weren't so crazy about. But this was fantastic.
Better than film, right? Because with film, you have multiple takes, and you end up just getting sick at the end.
Exactly.
That's neat. Well, you worked hard in high school. You were a diligent student and were accepted to one of the finest institutions in the South, Emory University.
Yes.
You know, that's right down the street from my alma mater, Agnes Scott College.
Yes, uh-huh.
You were one of the first in your family to attend college, were you not?
Yes. I have an older brother, and he went to college. But as far as both of my parents were in college when they were dating and got married, but then my mother dropped out of school so that my father could continue his studies. And so she never did get her degree. She tried to go back, but my parents were divorced when I was about three. And for her, juggling a full-time job plus raising two children and trying to go to night school, it was just it became too many conflicts for her, and she had to let that go.
She must have been very proud of you.
I think so, yes.
And it really wasn't traditional for every woman of our generation, our parents' generation, to go to college, so it's not unusual. But I think our mothers were proud of us, weren't they?
I think so.
My mother didn't go to college either, and I think she was really, really proud
mm-hmm.
when I finished. This is Sarah Robinson with Conscious Creating, and I'm talking with actor, director, and playwright Kimberly Yergin. So what made you decide to study theater and major in theater at Emory?
When I was in Nashville during my senior it was the summer before my senior year in high school, I had studied at the Tennessee Performing Arts Center. They had a student program there, and I studied with Ruth Sweet. And she had told me to not go to conservatory, that I should go to a liberal arts college and major in life. I, at the time, had no idea what that meant. But I didn't really see a career in theater as a viable option. I mean, how can you make a living doing the arts? And so I went to college, and I started with what some of my other passions were, which were science. And so I became a biology major, and then I was a chemistry major and a physics major, a computer science major, a classics major for a while.
You just tried it all out.
I did. I just explored everything, and as a result, did end up majoring in life. And I learned as much as I could about as many different things, but I just felt like it wasn't home for me. It's not where I needed to be spending the rest of my life. And so that was why I would keep moving from thing to thing. And then Emory didn't have a theater major when I started there, but they did have the theater program, so I was always taking classes and studying. And then I had a semester off, and I think actually I was on academic probation, but I've always chosen to remember it as I chose to take a semester off. But I think the truth actually is I was on academic probation.
Mm.
And because that was, I think that kind of became one of my rebellion forms
mm-hmm.
growing up, because that was always expected of me, to be very smart and to be getting the good grades. And so, you know, you always do what you feel is going to get you attention, so you go against whatever you think is expected of you. And so that was what I chose to do. And it ended up not really getting me the attention that I needed, because it didn't solve any of the problems that I was dealing with.
It became a little self-destructive, really.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's extreme. Well, as any kind of rebellion like that against mm-hmm. people who love you, to rebel against them is very self-destructive.
Right.
And so that was what I did. But the good thing that came out of that time away was that I reflected back on what had given me the most joy during my previous time there, and there were two things that were consistent. One was I was always taking a PE course, and they were always like crazy PEs. Like I took snow skiing and sailing and fencing and ballroom dance and racquetball.
Hmm.
And I thought, you know, what are the things that once I graduate, I'm not really, it's not going to be this easy for me to learn how to do it. And so I tried to do all kinds of crazy things.
That's great.
But they don't really have a major in PE. So then I looked, the other thing that I always was doing was theater. I was in a show from my first semester on, and at that point they did have the theater major, and I decided that that was what I wanted to do.
Hmm, that's a great story. So it wasn't just self-evident. And how would your parents have responded had you come home and said from the beginning, okay, I'm going to be an actor and I'm going to major in theater?
I don't think that they would have been as thrilled about my going to Emory if they had known that was my ultimate goal.
It's a pretty expensive school.
Exactly. And I know my mother had other ambitions for me, and for like 10 years after graduation, she would still say, so have you thought about law school again? Because for her, that was what she wanted for me, was to go to law school, because she wanted me to be in something that was more dependable as an income source, because she, you know, parents worry, and I can completely understand that.
Right.
But it wasn't my passion. It's not what it's not like breathing for me. And when I told them that I was very excited I would be going back to school, because I think they were afraid at that point that, you know, because once you take a semester off, the odds of returning are pretty slim. And so I told him, the good news is I am going back to college in the fall. The bad news is I'm going to be a theater major. And I was so excited about it. But Mom was very quiet. And then she said, okay, all right, okay. So we hung up the phone. I said, a couple minutes later, the phone rings, and it's my mother saying that my stepfather's going to be in town that weekend, and I need to make some time to have dinner with him. So the cavalry is coming in now to convince me that I need to be a good daughter and do something that's more reasonable with my life. And unfortunately, the person that she sent in to convince me of this was a person who had faced the same choice himself when he was in school. He was at Harvard. He had an agent who was getting him a lot of work in films. And his career was really starting to take off. But he had to make a choice. Did he want to be an attorney or did he want to be an actor? And he made the choice that he wanted to stay with law. And so he's coming down and talking to me about it. And he could see how sincere I was. And he remembered himself how he had had that same choice to make. And I think there are some times where he looks back and he wonders about the road not taken.
Sure.
Because he'll still do an occasional film. Oddly enough, he still gets calls, and he'll do an occasional thing, but I think he truly loves being a lawyer, and it is one of the things that I think he was born to do. And he was very receptive and understanding to my choice.
I think there's a connection between law and acting, the personalities that go into those two fields. I come from a long family of attorneys and politicians. My father went to law school and was a frustrated actor and wanted me to go to law school. Isn't
really?
That interesting? And tried to convince me, and I wanted to go to conservatory to study acting, and he insisted that I get a liberal arts degree and pursue, you know, at least prepare myself for the inevitable failure. You and I have a very similar story, and I think probably a story that other people would resonate with as well.
Oh, I think so.
So your stepfather, was he convincing, or did you read a subtext as saying, you know, go for it? I mean, what did you feel? Do you remember?
He did not even try to talk me out of it. He just wanted to hear what I was thinking, and to see for himself if I was serious about this or if it was something that I just thought was going to be fun or different. But he could see how sincere I was and how much it truly was something I was passionate about.
That's
and he responded
very loving.
To that, I think, because I think it resonated within him as well.
Hmm. That's very loving.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Which brings me to the thought that there is a lot of ego and a lot of negotiating of ego in our business.
Absolutely.
What have you learned about that over the years?
Oh, so much. I actually, over the past year, I have come to see things a lot more clearly. I've let go a lot of my own demons that have plagued me and made me a participant in that ego battle.
Hmm.
And
tell me about that.
We all have demons, and we all have damage. If we didn't, we wouldn't be in the arts. And one of the beautiful things about it is that it's all of that stuff that helps us tell our stories now. If I had not had the things that happened to me along my journey that were unfortunate, I was sexually molested as a child, and I felt very abandoned by my father when my parents divorced. And there were many things that really plunged me into some very dark places. And as a result of that, I can access things within myself that somebody that has not experienced those things can't. And I think it's wonderful, people who have happy childhoods. Again, that's a fantastic thing, but that's sort of the gift that was given to me that I can use to either be destroyed and held back by, or I can use it to help others and to show stories and to share ideas that people who don't have that kind of damage might not be able to see.
Well, and there's you and I are friends, and we've talked about this in the past, that
contemporary spirituality puts a lot of emphasis on light over darkness. Mm-hmm. And that's all well and good, but we're never going to get away from our shadow. We'll never be able to outrun our shadow. The shadow will always be there. And so, in the shadow of others interacting with us, as you described from your childhood. So, I think as artists, we have to have the yin and the yang, the dark and the light, present in our lives at all times. Would you agree with that? Or?
Definitely, definitely. I think because we draw from both. And you, if you try to remove the dark from you, it's a futile gesture because it's there and it's there for a reason. And it's like anything else. If you try to press things down, eventually pressure is going to build up and it's going to explode somewhere. And that was kind of what happened for me, is I had pressed things down. The abuse that I had received, I actually suppressed it so far back in my memory that I forgot it happened for about 10 years.
I think that's common for women who have been abused. They lose their memory.
Yes, it's a survival mechanism. And I think that we all have that. There are things that we need to do, especially as children, to survive some things that happen to us. And eventually, if we come to the point where we realize we don't need that armor anymore and we can start to let it go, that's when we can move forward. Because armor, it protects you for a while, but then eventually it just becomes heavy and it slows you down and it becomes an anchor that prevents you from growing.
Do you think there's anything about your experience working as an actor and a director and a writer, producer, anything specifically that you can point to that helped you get to this point of wisdom?
I think my studies, I've been studying with Richard Tadaguayo in Atlanta with the acting boot camp.
Right.
And the approach in there is about truth and stripping away all of the superfluous and just getting down to the bare bones truth. What is this character doing there? Why are they here? And how does their story need to be told without covering up or hiding anything? And what I've come to learn is that who we are on stage is who we are in life. And the more that I am hiding parts of myself or from others, that translates into my work too. And I cannot be fully open and fully expressive as an artist if I'm shying away from or hiding anything inside.
And the best directors will probe us, won't they?
I think so. And that's what I love doing as a director, and guiding and helping the actors to make their own discoveries. I'm a very organic director in my style. And then I like to come in, I understand everything I can about the play and have studied and done all of my homework, but I don't like to come in with ideas that are so set in stone that they can't evolve. And I love for the actors to bring ideas that we can then grow from, and I give them a foundation for, right, this is the structure for the play, so that we're not just starting from a million possibilities. But this is our foundation, and then we can build any kind of a house on this foundation that we want. And then I help guide it so that you don't have, you know, some crazy staircase that goes nowhere.
Right, and I like to ask a lot of questions when I'm directing you, so that the choices that the actor makes are his or her own choices, and they can commit to them emotionally. You do that as well, don't you?
Yes, I do. Rather than saying, this is what I need you to do, I will say, okay, so why did your character do that? To help them discover what the strongest choice is. Because sometimes they just will naturally have a strong choice, but they may not understand why they made it. And so if they don't understand what the character's journey is, the odds of them coming back to that again are pretty slim.
Just for the listeners, can you give an example of what a choice is, how actors make choices?
Certainly. In the show that I just directed, Black Comedy at Georgia Tech, there was, it's by Peter Schaefer, and it's a very dark one-act play. It is a comedy, but there are some moments in it that are not so light. And the actors were having difficulty because of the tone of it. It was sort of a like noises off, in that it was very fast-paced and very clipped dialogue. But then there comes this one moment of truth in the midst of all of this lying, because there's all this deception and all this subterfuge. And then there's this one moment where two characters speak the most honestly that happens at any point in the play. And so it was helping them discover, how does this, why does this exist in the play in the first place? And what does that mean for you and for your character? What's different for you here? What feels different? Do you see how the language, it's written in a different way? And the mood changes. So how can we feel that? What does that feel like when you say this language?
That's right. And then the choice might be something like what? How would that? What kind of actor? What kind of choice specifically would an actor make?
It could be completely changing the body language, where if the body was moving very quickly, now suddenly it becomes still, so that it can, so that the character can really take in the truth, as opposed to deflecting anything that might come to them throughout the rest of the play.
Right.
And the where their focus is much more direct in that moment than it is anywhere else in the play.
And being clear about what their intention is toward the other actor.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
I know a lot of our listeners are not particularly from theater, so I like to kind of illustrate these things for them so they understand. So after graduation, you founded your own theater company, ACT, Atlanta Classical Theater. And this was a bold move for a young college graduate. Was it frightening?
Actually, no. It probably should have been. Yes. What was wrong with me? I was actually in New York doing a workshop with some professors from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. And I was considering a move to New York, and I was looking for apartments and doing some job hunting in the, 13 spare minutes a day that we actually weren't working in class or rehearsing outside of class. And then one day during the second week, I had an epiphany moment and realized that what I truly wanted to do, Atlanta needed more than New York, because I wanted to do free theater in the park. I want to do theater that was accessible financially as well as artistically. And I felt New York had that, but Atlanta
didn't. Shakespeare in the Park in the summer. Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Well, that's wonderful, and you made quite a contribution to Atlanta Theater.
It was wonderful, especially the letters that we would receive from the students. We had weekday daytime performances in the park for school groups. So the only expense that they incurred was the bus transportation to get there. And we would get letters from students saying how happy they were that it was free, because they wouldn't have been able to go otherwise. And that was one of the most gratifying moments, I think, for me, was to see the impact that we could have on these kids and give them something that they had not gotten before. Many times we would, before the show, we would ask, how many people are seeing theater for the first time? And the hands that would go up everywhere. And we were their first exposure to this incredible art. And then they would want to go up and talk to the actors, and they would get so animated and so excited about what they just saw. You could even see them in the audience. They would start sitting back with their arms folded, show me something. I got to be here, but it's under duress. I'm just going to take a nap. It's a pretty day. I dare you to get my attention. But then before it was over, they were leaning forward, and they were laughing, and they were responding, and they were a part of the collective energy of theater.
This is Sarah Robinson with Conscious Creating, and I'm talking with actor, director, and playwright Kimberly Yergin. So what is it about classical theater that intrigues you, Kimberly?
I think the fact that it has stood the test of time for so long and yet is still so relevant, that it was written, especially with Shakespeare plays, written so many years ago, centuries ago, and yet it still speaks to the human condition today. And it just shows how universal we are, that we are just as connected to Sophocles' audience in ancient Rome as we are in Greece, as we are to Pinter today.
And, you know, I'm interested in mythology and mythic themes. And I do believe that the classics give us those mythic themes, and that's why they resonate for such long, long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun to explore those, and I want to support people who are creating mythic work today, and that's what conscious creating is about in some ways, highly creative work that offers a positive experience to society.
Yes.
What is your playwriting like? What have you written?
Most of my writing now is more in like journal form, memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an idea that I'm researching now, which I'm not exactly sure what direction it's going to take.
And that's good. You shouldn't.
Thank you. And so I don't know if it's going to end up as a book, or if it's going to be as a self-help book, or as a novel, or as a lecture series, or as a one-woman show, or I don't know yet. But a title actually came to me. I woke up yesterday and had this idea. The title is The Way Home.
Ah.
And that has truly resonated within me ever since then. And so I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen for it next, but it's about connecting with the past and honoring what's happened to you in your journey from the beginning, so that what is happening to you right now is about right now. Because so often, when we're talking to someone and they say something, and it subconsciously it triggers a memory of when we were 5 years old, so we respond to them with that five-year-old child's memory as opposed to responding to them with what we have right now.
So we become reactive as opposed to
responsive.
Responsive.
Exactly.
Hmm.
And it's because we never have acknowledged what happened to us when we were five and come to terms with that.
The title intrigues me because, you know, I've been really interested in this theme of homecoming.
Yes.
And we worked together on a project with homecoming as a big theme.
Mm-hmm.
My play Refuge, we did a workshop production March of 2006 together, and you played the what I consider to be the central role, even though it is an ensemble piece, the role of Sophia.
Mm-hmm.
Can you relate your journey of homecoming through originating that role?
Certainly. I think that everything comes to us, again, like I said before, it's when we need it. And that's a play that came to me at a time where that was what I truly needed. And one of the wonderful things that I find as an actor is that I get to live lives that weren't mine. And I get to explore experiences that perhaps I missed along the way. And for me, as much as my parents did love me and care for me, it still was not home, because there were things that happened and parts of that environment that never made me feel totally at rest there. And so this play came to me at a time where I was searching for that, and I was consciously searching for that, as opposed to the subconscious quest that we are all constantly on, looking for home. And so in this play, I was able to really delve into that, and what does home mean, and what does it feel like, and why do we seek that so much, and what are we willing to do, and what do we become to find home? And it was the transformation of that that I loved exploring. And being the maternal caregiver and the creator of home in that show was extremely, it opened up parts of me that had been closed for a long time. And so I got to explore, you know, rooms inside me that were dusty and hadn't had the lights turned on ever. And so I got to discover parts of me that that were new, and got to share that in a very safe and warm environment, which is part of, I think, the definition of home, is something that feels safe and warm and secure.
Ultimately, we did have a safe, warm environment in that group, did we not?
I think so, yes.
It was an ensemble cast, and I ended up directing it at the last, sort of the last two weeks, and we pulled together and did create a sense of warmth and understanding and acceptance that mm-hmm. has remained with me. And I think what you describe in your inhabiting the role of Sophia, the goddess of wisdom, what a tough role to play for any
Definitely
of us.
Definitely not typecasting me.
One of the things that you give as a concrete example of how art can specifically lead to personal transformation.
Yes.
Or help us in our own, or sort of complement us in the transformation that's ongoing.
Absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think because if we as artists are not transformed by our art, then how can we possibly expect the audience, the receivers of our art, to be transformed?
That's right. That's right. Well, I wanted to go back to Atlanta Classical Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1997, only one year after you opened, you produced an innovative staging of Hamlet.
Yes.
Tell me about that. I read a newspaper article on that.
Oh, it was the most incredible experience for me.
You love Shakespeare.
I do. I do love it very much. And for this particular project, I had a friend that I had met in New York at that workshop the previous year, and he was going to come down and direct the show for us and play Hamlet. Very awesome responsibilities doing both. And
that's huge.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But I had a great deal of faith in him, and we together researched and put together our script of Hamlet. And so we spent hours studying in the library, reading the folio, reading all of the quartos, and deciding what we wanted from each, rather than taking a general script, which is what very often happens, is you'll use the Arden, or our production is using the Pelican or whatever.
And explain to the audience what are you talking about here? It's
oh,
not
certainly.
Just right.
Mm-hmm. Shakespeare did not publish any of his plays. They were all published posthumously. So there is a lot of debate on, well, for one thing, if he was actually the author of them.
Right.
But which of these are his? So then what the scholars do today is they look at all of these sources and will then determine what they think is the most likely scene or language or punctuation even. And then that's what they will put into their version that they release. And Arden has always been one of my favorites. It's a very academic version of it, but I guess that appeals to the academic in me. And so I like the way that it interprets the text, and I like the choices that it makes. But I also felt that for this particular production, we wanted to go deeper and make our own choices. And in the readings of it, in one of the folios, the quarto, which is considered the bad quarto, and the reason it would be called a bad quarto is because it deviates the most from what is accepted as the truest script, and it may have like some odd tangents to it. And in this particular quarto, there is a scene with Gertrude, the queen, Hamlet's mother, and we found it very enlightening about her character. And we wanted to see what would happen if we used that. How does that affect the play? And so we chose to use that scene, and we pieced together all of what we wanted to do so that we had the play in total. And we then went for a weekend, and this was an absolutely incredible weekend. And we worked nonstop cutting the script. We would work separately and decide what our cuts were, and then we would come back together, and we would fight over it. No, you can't cut that line. It's so important because of this. And
collaboration.
Why are you keeping that? And so we really debated everything and every word and every nuance so that the results of our script was so clean and so tight, and we knew why everything existed in it and why everything was not there. And we didn't want to remove anything that we did not completely understand. So we would dive in and do as much research as we could on everything that was there. I worked with one director a few years ago, and it was for a production of Romeo and Juliet. And I asked her about some of her cuts to the script, and she said that, well, she cut that line because she didn't know what the word meant. I thought, oh, my goodness. Who am I working with here? I've entrusted myself to this person who has a very alien process to me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, that's working in a tertiary market, I think.
Yes.
We love Atlanta.
Oh, we do indeed. But occasionally you do get these really joyous moments like that, and like Sophia for Refuge. I loved all the research that you had done and brought to it, because that, I think that harkened back to me with my memories with Hamlet and how much I loved doing that. And so seeing your process and how specific things were, and things were there for a reason, otherwise it wouldn't be there, that resonated for me.
Well, who was it that said that art is in the details?
Yes.
And I do believe that. I think as an actor, as a writer, as a director, in any art form, as a visual artist, one has to be specific.
Yeah.
So much of the art now that is specific sometimes seems very, it lacks universality. It seems self-indulgent sometimes, and that's one thing I object to in contemporary theater.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there is work that is, I'm thinking of poetry, for example, that lacks specificity. Very general terms are used. And I talked with Natalie Goldberg not too long ago, the great writing teacher and writer, and she says, just don't tell me that you love someone. Give an example specifically in an image, and then we'll know you love that person.
Oh, that's lovely.
And I like that. And that's what we try to do.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting fact about you is your interest in stage combat.
Yeah.
And people wouldn't know this on the radio, but you're a petite woman and a very gentle, graceful woman. How did you become interested in broadswords and daggers and rapiers and all of this?
Through my company, ACT, since we were doing so many classical plays, of course, many of them have combat of some sort in it. And there was a wonderful fight choreographer in town, David Coyle, who came to us and said, I see that you are auditioning this play. I just want to offer you, if you don't already have a fight choreographer, I'd like to offer my services. Well, again, I was so naive, and I didn't even really know what a fight choreographer was at that point. So I met with him and talked with him and discovered what he could bring to the telling of our story. And I was fascinated by it. And he did the fight choreography for several shows with us, but then he introduced me to Scott Mann, who had the stage combat studio here in Atlanta, and that was where I started studying, and have continued studying with some incredible fight masters across the country, and growing my skills and broadening the weapons with which I've worked to the point where I now do fight choreography myself. And also do it for film. And
It's and you incredible. Did it for our production of Refuge. And yes. Great, impeccable
Thank
work.
Thank you. One of the things that I love most about it is that stage combat, it can have the same impact on the production as what I would consider music in a musical, when it's really solid, and that it advances the story. And the story would be less without it. A great example would be like West Side Story. There is no song in there that doesn't tell me something more about everyone that's a part of the song. And stage combat is the same thing. It should have a story within itself. There should be a beginning and a middle and an end to it. And if it doesn't enlighten the audience about it, then I don't think it was a very strong piece, and it didn't serve the story very well if it doesn't move me in some way. And fight choreographers can be used for anything from the more expected, like a sword fight, or even if an actor has to trip and fall. Because the bottom line is, you want your actors to be safe. You want them to be able to do the same thing over and over and over and not get hurt, because you need them tomorrow night for the show.
Right.
And in film work, it's even more necessary, I believe, because not only does the actor have to do it over and over, but because there is such a need for continuity that it has to be consistent over and over. And when the camera angle moves, it has to look like it's the same thing.
That's right. So it really has to be choreographed.
Yes. Because if you're in an audience in a theater production, depending on where you're sitting, you really are seeing a different fight, because you have a different point of view. But with film, you always have to be aware of where the camera is, and that's the point of view that you gauge the fight toward, so that it looks consistent. And again, tells the story and advances the story.
And it's fun.
It is. It is. I enjoy doing it. It's great exercise, for one thing, so in that sense, it makes me feel great when I'm doing it. But also, as an artist, I love the expression of it. And I love doing something that is challenging for me, something that I didn't necessarily know I could do. And when a fight choreographer brings that to me and asks me to do something, I'm like, you want me to do what? I don't. My body doesn't move that way. And then they work with me, and slowly I realize, okay, my body can move that way. And it's very exciting and very fulfilling for me as an artist to go beyond my own expectations for myself.
One of the things I think people who are not in the theater might not know, and even people in the theater who haven't had much experience with fight choreography, is that the fight choreographer is an artist who not only creates a sequence of movements and rehearses them with the actors, but makes artistic choices that may take the script in one direction or another. And we saw this in Refuge, when you choreographed a scene where you had to make a decision, is this going to imply rape of a woman, or will it just be bullying?
Yes.
And that made a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. That's where communication is so important between the director and the fight choreographer, because ultimately it's the director's vision. And so the fight choreographer may have some great bells and whistles that they want to do, but if it doesn't advance the story, or, as you're pointing out, it takes it off in a different direction, and it opens up a Pandora's box of questions for the audience that never get answered in the text, then it's not helping tell the story. So you really need that communication and that give and take, so that the director is saying, it's still giving a lot of artistic freedom to the fight choreographer, as opposed to, you know, some I've worked with, I've come in and said, okay, we want to slap here. I want you to punch somebody who gets punched here, and then they fall down. I'm like, okay, and I can do that. And then I try to bring my own creative process within that, but they've given me a smaller box in which to work. But still, I got a lot of space inside that box that I can play with. And then sometimes you'll come in and they just say, all right, this is what happens before, and they end up here, and then we pick up here, and they need to be at this point. What happens in between, I don't care. Just do something.
Well, what I noticed was I also wrote the play that I was directing, mm-hmm. So my intention, or what I had visualized in the scene that I wrote, the one that you took in the rape direction.
Mm-hmm.
I had not considered rape,
mm-hmm.
but what I found was what you brought as an artist to it and your vision of it, taking it to an edge, gave the story more interest for me. So you, this is why, to me, art is so collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
It's everyone working together to bring a vision. And I could have said, no, that's not really what I want to do because it's not what I intended. But I thought what you brought to it made it edgier and better. Now, the producer didn't agree with it, but that's okay. You know,
thank you.
That's the way it is. You know, we all sort of work together and argue and
mm-hmm.
make decisions, and ultimately it is generally the director's decision.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I'm a firm believer in always making the strongest choice possible, because again, that's why it's there.
That's right.
And so what is the most bold choice that you can make? And then that's what I want to present. And then if, again, as the director, you had said no, that tells a different story than the one that fits, then, you know, I'm perfectly willing to adjust
mm-hmm.
for that. But I always think that the whole point of any art is risk. And you have to take risk, and you've got to go out there, and you've got to go out on that limb as far as you can until you start to hear the tree starting to break. And at that point, you either stop or you say, all right, maybe I'm going to go just a little bit further. The branch may fall out from under you, or you may discover something that's fantastic because you took that risk. But when we play it safe and we just hold on to the trunk of the tree, then there's no risk for us, and there's no bold reality that gets created.
And this is where rehearsal is so much fun. And when I realized I did not want to work as an actor as much as I wanted to work as a director and a writer, was, you know, I enjoyed the rehearsal process better than I did doing 8 shows a week
mm-hmm.
once the piece got set. And you've become interested in film in recent years, and mm-hmm. you don't have much rehearsal time in film.
No, sometimes none at all.
And you've starred and been featured in a number of independent films.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious, how has the experience of filmmaking or working as an actor in film differed from theater?
There are many differences. One is that you have to let go of a lot of control. And for me, that has been a very liberating process. Because, again, that was one thing, that was part of my armor that I took on to protect me all these years. With the more control I had, then the less things could hurt me and the more I can, you know, survive life. But in film, you don't have that. Because the story is really put together in the editing room. On set, you may do a scene 4 different ways, and you don't know which one of those they're going to end up using.
And unless you're really good friends with the editor, you have no control. You could
well,
be edited out of the film.
Well, you're also producing, or you're involved in other ways,
right,
exactly.
Right.
But if the only hat that you wear with that production is the actor, then what you bring on the day is it. And so there is that sense of giving over control and trusting these other artists that they are going to do the thing that best serves the piece. So you really are very much in service to the project as opposed to anything else, because they will decide what gets used. And what you feel like may have been your best take may not be the one that best serves the story. And you have to let go of that control and say, you know what, I'm sorry you didn't use the take right, because I really hit it and the tear was just perfect. But, you know, that didn't tell the story the best.
Or the gaffer didn't get the light in the right, you know, place. Or,
exactly.
Or something.
We ran out
like
of film
that.
In the middle
technical.
Of that take.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So you never know what the reasons are why that can happen, but what it creates within me as an artist is the need to be fully present every single time, because you don't know. If you're doing an outdoor shoot, it may start to rain, and so they don't get to do another take. This may be the only take you get. There may be some power may go out on site, and that might be it. So you really have to fully invest and be 100% every second. And during the rehearsal process in theater, while that is the goal, it's very rarely the reality.
And the great thing about theater is the process is always evolving.
Yes.
Now, some people don't agree with that. They think you should set your performance and, you know, the exploration stops. But I have never found that to be true, because when you're in the moment with another actor or group of actors in a scene, you might be moved to make a different choice.
Precisely. And you don't know what's going to happen. We were doing a production of the Scottish play, for those who are superstitious.
Go ahead, say it. People won't know.
Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Right.
And this was just after Princess Diana had died. And so one of our actors, the actor who was playing Macbeth, was British. He had lived here in the States for most of his life, but he was from there. His family was from there. So he had many ties to that. And the show resonated for us all differently that day, to think of that loss and what that means to the entire country and how it affects the world. And so everyone that was there that day, the actors and the audience, we shared the exact same historical moment in her loss that we all had on the day. Whereas in film, you know, what happens between the day that you shoot it may be a year before an audience actually sees it, or even longer if they're watching it on DVD. And so they've got a very different place that they're approaching it from. A film that was set in New York before 9/11 will have a very different feel than a film that is shot after 9/11, but if the audience is seeing it after that incredible date, it affects us differently. It's because time has moved and we're in a different time. But in theater, I mean, you're breathing the same air, and it becomes this unity in the room that doesn't exist in film or for visual artists. What they're feeling on the day that they create their art is going to be different than for the person who experiences it later.
And all kinds of things are going on in the dressing rooms and in the green room.
Exactly.
That, you know, we can say we're professionals, but they affect us.
Yes. And for writers, the same thing. When you write a poem, unless you happen to share that with the reader and say, you know, I wrote it on this date and it's dedicated to whatever impacted you at that moment to inspire you to create that piece, it's for your audience, they're not going to receive everything that you felt. And, of course, that's the choice of the artist, is if they want to give all of that information or to let it be, you know, more pure and just resonate as it resonates.
So I'm curious, what are you working on now, or what do you hope to work on? Do you have anything upcoming?
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm writing, I'm researching mostly The Way Home. Started, like, scribbling down a few ideas, but it hasn't started taking shape yet. And I'm going to be the second assistant director for a project that's coming up, a feature-length independent film called I Am the Bluebird. And it starts work next month.
And is that here in Atlanta? Or?
It will be. It's filming here in Atlanta, and I believe they have one weekend that they go up to Chicago to shoot. But it's exciting because they're using Atlanta talent and really exploring the incredible wealth of artistic brilliance that is here in Atlanta. They have an incredible cast, and I'm just very excited to be part of the process.
Have you ever had that particular role of second assistant director?
I have. I've worked behind the scenes on several independent projects in town, some commercials and some short films. And I recently worked on The Bridge, which was a Crimson Noro Productions and Atlanta acting boot camp classes, a co-production between the two, and I worked as their second AD.
Would you like to be a film director one day?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Yes, I would. I would. I recognize that I don't know nearly enough right now because there are so many technical requirements, I feel, to doing that, that just being a stage director and being able to bring all of those things together, it's very different on a film set because you're also responsible for so many other things that, for me, as a director, I would want to also understand more about lighting and sound and camera angles, and so that I can be more responsive to those technicians and to those artists and what they bring. And I feel on stage I can definitely do that, and I can communicate with them and help them achieve their vision for that part of the storytelling. But in film, there's still a lot I don't know.
And that's a good place to be.
Absolutely. I love being in a place where I don't know things.
Kimberly Yergin, thank you for joining me on Conscious Creating. This has just been great.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I had a wonderful time.
Thank you for joining us on Conscious Creating. We invite you to visit our website at consciouscreating.net to give us your feedback, and visit our store where you'll find books, CDs, and DVDs by our guests. Music for today's show is from Chakra Suite by Stephen Halperin and is used here with permission. Sound engineering is provided by Billy Fallon with Out of Sync Productions. This is Sarah Robinson, host and executive producer, wishing you a fruitful week of conscious creating.